This week on Pop of Culture, photographs of the rich and famous. And you.
You can't just hold your finger down on the button and take like 40 pictures. It takes a long time.
We'll also take a journey to the Indianapolis Public Library.
I had people call me, I saw your art at the library. You know, so being here in this space is really, it's really an honor.
And we'll get some FaceTime with Facing Project host J.R. Jameson to learn what he's working on when he's not behind the mic. Coming up!
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at IndianaPublicRadio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture, and we have taken the show outside on Woo-hoo! This beautiful day. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. We're going to start today by focusing our lens on photographer Ron Brown.
Ron forged a successful career path as a photographer for television and the film industry in Hollywood, California. I started by asking him, why'd he move back?
That was the end of 2019, and I felt like I had accomplished what I went out there to accomplish. So I sold my house and jumped in my Jeep and drove back.
Nice. I know that you do a lot of work with the community, mm-hmm. and I want to know, do you have a similar feeling about the community that you find in Indiana that you experienced in Hollywood?
Believe it or not, the community in Hollywood is pretty tight. Like I met an awful lot of people, like a couple of actors lived across the street from me, and it was so easy. I found it very easy. And I was talking about this at the Art Allegiance luncheon, and we were talking about people from the Midwest moving out there. And one of the first things people ask you, well, where are you from? From Indiana. And they go, oh, we love people from the Midwest because they work hard.
Well, that's a pretty good reputation to have.
Absolutely.
Well, when you say you felt like you did everything you needed to do in Hollywood, mm-hmm. what did you do there?
I had a digital technician company, which had taken several years to get into, and would furnish cameras and computers and basically all it took to capture the images and then process them out and deliver them to the client.
Okay. So Robert G. LaFrance says that you can take a mere mortal and immortalize them in film. So can you elaborate a little bit on whether you agree with that and what inspires you to photograph people?
Everything as far as photography goes that means things to me is the light, because the light is how you create everything. I don't use what, let's say, a normal portrait photographer in Indiana would use. You know, I have big movie lights I use part of the time, and small strobes, and just anything. I don't count anything out. Different situations demand a different feel. And when I approach a person, I just kind of stand there and look at them for a moment. Not enough to be creepy, hopefully, but enough to understand how the lines in their face are, if they turn this way or that way, which side I want to photograph.
That's interesting, because I've had the pleasure of seeing some of your work, and you talk about light, and many of your images, I feel like I see this internal light. So are you considering internal and external values when you talk about this?
Yeah, I mean, if you spend a few minutes with people and talk with them for a moment here or there, and once the light is right, you can almost see the internal. Mm-hmm.
So I read a quote that you said, you were talking to some other photographers, and you said that you've come to the idea that there are no rules in photography. And how did that come about?
My mentor in California was Frank Ockenfels III, and an extremely talented photographer, and has been working in the TV and movie industry for many, many years. And I've learned to do a lot of it. I mean, everything I do now, I do on my own. But I still think back how if someone said something to him, he would react in a certain fashion to that would never be negative. It would be positive toward the end result.
That's really interesting. So it's kind of situational relationship.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of that, so what's the situation you find yourself in with the Muncie community now that you've made it home?
Well, I got back in February 2020.
Oh.
So it was like a few weeks prior to COVID closing everything down. So I bought a mannequin on Amazon, had it shipped in. Her name is Julia. And I got her a red wig. Anyway, and so at the time, I had bought my mother's house and I was living there. And I would set up things in the living room and photograph the mannequin. And then as things broke up, and about a year and a half ago, I bought a building on Walnut Street. And I have so much room now. It's great. I have basically three studios in it, and I live in it. So it affords me to have different sets in different rooms and walk people back and forth, you know. I don't use the same ones all the time. I try to fight to never use the same ones, even though I think it might work, because I just don't want to become that machine that makes everybody look the same.
Well, I guess I'm interested to know. I know you recently were a guest curator for an exhibit that's up now at mm-hmm. the DOMA, the David Owsley Museum of Art. And the exhibit is called People and Places, 1873 to 2000. And I would like you to talk to us a little bit about your experience as being the guest curator and how it relates to your own work, if indeed it did.
Well, it was interesting. I had the entire collection of photography to go through and pick. I picked 41 images out of it. I needed them to be of people, not just objects or landscapes or something like that, because people was what I worked around all the time in California and 28 different countries around the world as well.
Casually mentioned. Wow.
Yes. And in fact, I'd picked all but one image out, and someone was talking about, well, don't you want this one? And it was a picture of a pepper. And I was like, not a person. They said, well, it kind of looks like a person.
Well, what's going on with this Hollywood photo shoot? Can you tell us more about that?
Well, they just approached me. The folks at the museum approached me and they said, we want to do this shoot. And since you came from Hollywood, how about a Hollywood photo shoot? And I go, okay.
Excellent.
Yeah. It's taking a bit to make it happen. It's on the second floor in the museum where the last exhibit was. And they're sending a van to my studio to load up a bunch of equipment and bring it. And then I'll spend a day or so setting it up so that we can have two setups. I don't know that there'll be time to swap everything on a setup while people are there, because it's 2 hours the first day and 2 hours the second day, and it's first come, first serve.
Okay. Yeah, and I believe that's March 14th, which is a Friday, and March 15th.
Yes.
I like what you were talking about in terms of You don't want to become a machine and you mix it up.
Mm-hmm.
So what is that? Even if you know something works, you say you mix it up. What do you mean? Can you elaborate on that a little more?
Well, it could be just simply moving one light 4 feet one direction, or twisting the background, or throwing a wrinkle across the middle of the background, or, you know, anything to make it different.
Excellent. It's kind of getting out of your comfort and know, and what you know will work.
Mm-hmm.
Is it? Okay. I like that experimental spirit, Ron. And is there anything else you'd like to talk to us today about? Photography, your work?
Well, it's really interesting, the exhibit that I curated. It has 4 Marilyn Monroe pictures in it and 5 Salvador Dali's in it. And it's a very mixed group of photographs. They're all people, but a lot of them are from the Depression era. And it covers almost any type of person you can imagine.
Well, you mentioned some of the photos, and I've had the pleasure of going to the show. Mm. And the Philip Hansen images, I learned about jumpology. So if you want to see Marilyn Monroe jumping.
Yes, there is. He caught her in mid-jump. But my favorite of the jumping ones that are there are the cats and Dali.
Yes.
One of the first times I went down into the archives to pick prints out, the Dali one came out of the drawer, and I was like, okay, I have to know more about him. So I went to the bookstore and bought a book on him. And what a wacky guy, but what an amazing talent.
Yes, that picture is fabulous.
They used an 8x10 view camera to make those pictures because of the time period that it happened in. And it's a huge camera, but you put a film holder in and pull a dark slide out and take it, and then you put the dark slide in and flip it around and pull the other dark slide out and take another one, because there are 2 sheets that fit in each holder. And so you can't just hold your finger down on the button and take like 40 pictures. It takes a long time. Anyway, that picture took 28 photos to make it. And Halsman's daughter was the cat wrangler. And I don't know who was Dali's wrangler, but I'm certain that there was one. But it's just it's a fun picture, and I love reading about it and how it was done and all that. And there's also water flying through the air. So they had to wrangle the water, wrangle Dali, and wrangle cats.
I'm glad you spoke a little bit about the process to make it happen, because it seems to defy everything, you know, that has to do with gravity as we know it.
Truly, yes.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today, Ron.
My pleasure.
Ron Brown is a photographer who now resides in Muncie. Listening to Pop of Culture, I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. The Indianapolis Public Library has an exhibit at their central branch called Meet the Artist that the library says is an avenue for local, talented African-American artists to show off their creative works. IPR's Daniel Huber sends us this postcard.
Upon entering the library, one of the first things you may notice is that art is everywhere. There are displays on every floor of the building, and this is thanks to 2 people.
I think we're the kickoff of what we call Black excellence here in the city.
Anthony Radford, who goes by Tony, is curator and founder of Meet the Artists. He started the exhibit 37 years ago. As an artist himself, Radford created the show to give a platform for up-and-coming African-American artists.
I was inspired by an artist named Joe Holiday. His work was here on exhibit in '87, I think. And it was actually, you know, I didn't know a lot of black artists, so it was like the first real black art that I'd seen. And Joe painted black people, kings and queens, ordinary black people, and his colors were brilliant, you know. So I was inspired. And I wanted to know who put this show together, and they told me a lady named Barbara Alexandra, who was on the African-American History Committee. So I called Barb up and told her I wanted to do the show the following year, and she said, okay. I called her back about a week later, because as I said, I was just starting. I didn't have enough works to fill up the entire space. So after, like say, being out and going to other exhibits and not seeing, you know, people of color in these exhibits, although everywhere I went, I was treated well and had a good time and met some influential people. But I called her back and said, well, let's just do, why don't we do a group show and honor African-American artists with a reception and, you know, some food, a band. And so she invited me to a meeting. I went and told, she said, Tony, just tell them what you told me. I did that, and before I left out the door, they were saying, okay, Tony, let's do it. I didn't really, like, say, know any artists, or, but I knew it was an opportunity to be able to have a platform to now be able to show African-American artists' work.
Since then, the exhibit has brought in fashion designers and novelists. The library hosts a yearly gala to open up the exhibit. It features a fashion show and live music. Cordia Watkins, chairperson for the library's African-American History Committee, works with Radford to make the show happen every year, and she has seen the exhibit evolve over time.
You know, it is amazing. When this event first started, it was really small. And we have hit numbers over 1,500 people have been to this event, and they come in. We were right at about 1,300 before COVID. This year, our numbers are at like 955. So people came here, and they, you know, it's almost sometimes like a reunion. People wait for this to happen. They love the fashion show. We started this, and we have to have the fashion show and all of the above because, unfortunately, our community was not used to just coming to an art opening. They didn't have the appreciation. And I believe that we have shifted because people now are buying artwork, they're buying books, and so they are getting what we want, which is, this is our community. These, as you see, the artwork is amazing, very talented people. And so we want people to be excited about what's going on in our own community.
Many pieces of art are loaded with symbolism of the African-American community. One clear example is from Radford himself. He has some of his own work installed in the exhibit. One of his favorites is a mixed-media collage called The Liberation of Uncle Ben. In the background is a repeating pattern of the Uncle Ben's Rice logo. The center explodes in a tapestry of symbols and figureheads of the civil rights, Black Power, and Black Lives Matter movements. In the foreground is a paintbrush with bottle caps for eyes, wearing a blue tuxedo and a gold chain, and holding a pistol.
Uncle Ben was actually a maitre d' in Chicago, and to the owners of the Rice Company, thought that he had an honest face, paid him I think $50 to be the like of Uncle Ben, and that's all they ever paid him. And of course Uncle Ben's rice went on to make millions of dollars. The story, really wanted to tell the story of Uncle Ben and what happened to him and how blacks were used in advertisement and didn't get paid, got treated wrong, and stereotypes. And so that was just Uncle Ben becoming liberated and striking out.
Another artist who has infused deep historical nuances into her work is Tania Wineglass. African American history is so personal to her work, it's in her last name.
It's actually a name that was handed down. Wineglass is a slave name. So my ancestors made wine glasses, and a lot of times the slaves would take on the name of the job that they did. So I do a lot of traditional work. I actually have a master's in ceramics and painting. So I do a lot of traditional work as well. I do a lot of quilting. What a lot of slaves did was they learned these crafts and they were able to buy their way out of slavery.
Wineglass taps into her roots when creating art. This is seen on full display in one of her pieces, Generational Healing. This acrylic painting is part of a series called My Healing Heart.
And what it is just basically my healing journey that I'm sharing with other people that they could possibly be going through the same things.
The painting depicts two hands holding a stitched and bandaged heart. Flowers grow out of the heart. The hands have quilt patterns and paper airplanes fly across the canvas.
And the heart is being repaired, so it has band-aids, silver or gold thread, staples, anything to do to, which means that anything we can do to get back to healing. And so the peach roses represent gratefulness and generosity. There are seven paper airplanes. Paper airplanes represent our guardian angels. And I referred to the slave quilts and stuff like that. Those are slave quilt patterns tattooed on the hands.
This is Wineglass's first time having her art shown at Meet the Artists, and she's excited.
It meant a lot. I was elated. I was elated that I actually got in. So it's a beautiful journey. My artistic career has been a beautiful journey. I can't imagine my life without art. So it's like I eat, sleep, breathe, think art. If I don't do art, then there's something really wrong with me during that time. So it's like, you know, even my friends were like, when's the last time you painted? When's the last time you made something? And so I try to make sure that I create. Matter of fact, I just left the clay studio just to get over here.
Alongside Wineglass's creations are works of Maddie Jones. Jones has her works shown throughout the years at Meet the Artists.
I would say at least 10 years.
As both an artist and an author, Jones says she writes nonfiction, but likes to draw people in her art. Her pieces lean into this year's theme of the Pearl Experience. Her favorite piece she's done for this year is a painting called Dressed in Black. It is a side profile of a woman. She wears a large black strapless dress and a pearl earring as large as her posture is bold.
But she's kind of represent the fashion part of what was going on with the show this year. She just reminds me of my daughter. My daughter Dee Dee. She looks, after, I didn't mean for her to, but after I finished her, she just looks like her to me. When I'm painting, I don't realize a part of me is coming out in the painting. Even sometimes, I drew a guy and painted him, and he ended up looking just like my nephew, you know.
Joan says she likes to play around with the looks of the people she draws.
Our unique features are, you know, our lips and our eyes, and mostly the different shades of color that we are. So you can't really tell. A lot of times you can't even tell if it's a black woman or not, because I like that idea too. I go that way as well. Our different shades and our different personalities and the different ways we represent ourselves. I like the themes of really empowerment. I know that's like a cliche, everybody uses that, but it's impressions. You know, I have to just, a person's personality or character.
Jones and many others are preparing for the Fourth Friday celebration on March 28th. That day, the library becomes an intimate environment where the public has the opportunity to talk to the artists and authors, see them working on other projects, buy artwork from the artists, and get books signed by the authors. This year's Fourth Friday comes with much anticipation, as it is the library's first one since the pandemic. The closing event leads to many opportunities for the artists, especially, as Wineglass points out, at a place as important as the Central Library.
It's not like one of the smaller libraries, which those are still nice, but everybody comes down to the Central Library. And so it's very important that it's actually here and highlighted. And like if visitors come to the city, they're going to come to the Central Library. You know.
Jones agrees.
After the show, the opening, I had people call me. I saw your art at the library. You know, so being here in this space is really, it's really an honor.
In Indianapolis, Daniel Huber.
The Indianapolis Public Library's 37th Meet the Artist exhibition is open during library hours through Saturday, March 29th. The InPrint Festival on Ball State's campus is a festival of first books.
I sat down with the woman in charge to learn more. The InPrint Festival of First Books is a two-day celebration of literary writing and publishing on the campus of Ball State University. And here to talk about quite a milestone when it comes to the festival is Katie Didden, and she is the director of the creative writing program at Ball State and one of the organizers of InPrint. Katie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's such a good thing to be here. Thanks.
And what a great reason to celebrate, right? A huge milestone this year for the
festival.
Yes,
we are so excited. It's at 20 years of the InPrint Festival. So we've planned a huge party and we hope everyone will come.
And what was the original, what was the impetus behind starting the festival 20 years ago?
Well, 20 years ago, my colleague Jill Christman had this amazing insight that while our students might be very inspired by a famous author coming to campus, it was often hard for them to relate to someone who was at the late stages of their writing career. Mm. So Jill thought, why not invite writers who have just gone through the process of publishing their first book? Because our students might have a ton of drafts on their computers and they might wonder, how do I move from having those drafts to actually getting published? So Jill set up the festival where on the first night, a fiction writer, a nonfiction writer, and a poet who had just published their first book would come to campus and read from those books and talk about what it was like to get those published. So the second night was an editing panel where we also invite an editor to campus so that we can talk about what it's like from the other side. What are editors looking for? And this turned out to be such a terrific formula. It really has become the heart of the creative writing program. What I love about it is that students can get outside of our individual classes and see themselves as a huge, large community of writers.
Yeah, I love that. I love the whole idea of when you're getting someone who has just published their first book, all of the things they went through are still really fresh in their minds,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely.
And
yes.
So they can offer those insights, those tips, those tricks, that support, really, right? Isn't that what most writers, if they're wanting to launch out and actually take it from the draft on the computer to actually publishing? I mean, that's a huge leap. And it sounds like Imprint has become what a wonderful supportive community for that.
For sure. And one of the great benefits of the festival is that the panels themselves become really good friends. So we hear from them that they stay in touch even across the years once they meet here at Ball State. So that's also a great benefit.
Oh my gosh, I love that. So tell us about some of the authors that are going to be here this year.
So this year, to mark the 20th anniversary, which is a huge milestone, we thought we would switch it up a little bit. And we have invited a panel of all Ball State alumni.
What?
Yes.
That's awesome.
So we are welcoming nonfiction writer Elisa Sachin and novelist Jay Coles and poet Matt Hart and author and editor Gretchen Stelter back to campus. So this is a little different because some of these authors have multiple books. So, for example, Matt Hart has 13 books. But we're still hoping that since they're Ball State alums, our students will see, oh, yes, this is a pathway for me.
Yes.
This is someone that I can network with. And also I could see myself as a Ball State author publishing books and being part of this larger alumni network. So
talk a little bit about the fact that this is open to the community. So who should come to this event?
Anyone who's interested in writing, mm-hmm. Anyone who has a connection to Ball State. What we love about it is that it's kind of like a mixtape. So that first night on the panel, you'll hear different styles of writing. So you'll hear a novelist and a poet and a nonfiction writer. And we'll also have a literary fair where you can come and learn about the creative writing program and you can meet the authors. They'll do a book signing.
Nice.
We're also hoping to have a table featuring our books by our alumni, and we'll have our student groups there. So anyone who's interested in hearing really good literature should come to that first night. And then we've changed things up for the second night. We've moved the editing panel to the afternoon. That's still open to the public. Mm-hmm. It'll be at 12:30 in Letterman Building 125. And because a lot of our authors are also editors. So, for example, Alicia works for The Rumpus and Matt edits literary journals.
Wow.
And Gretchen's an editor. So we'll be having conversations with them about what it means to be both author and editor. But then we created a new event on Thursday night, which is called In Print In Person. And it's a writing showcase. So we're welcoming back two other alumni. So best-selling memoirist Ashley C. Ford, author of Somebody's Daughter, and J.R. Jameson, who's one of the co-founders of the Facing Project with Kelsey Timmerman, and who's also the author of Hillbilly Queer, have agreed to co-MC this event.
Wow.
And we'll be having showcasing writers, you know, some alumni writers and undergraduate writers and faculty and graduate writers. Everyone will be giving a very brief reading, again, like a mixtape, and it'll be a really big party. So we're looking forward to that.
Oh, I love that. And again, that is open to the public
as
well.
Yes, we hope everyone will come. We're really excited to show off our creative writing program to everyone. And we hope it'll be a welcoming place and a place that will inspire inspire everyone.
Give us the rundown, Katie, again, of the dates of the festival and the times and where people can get more information if they want a little more information about the authors involved.
So the first event is on Wednesday, March 19th, and it starts at 7 p.m. with a literary fair. That's in the Student Center Ballroom. And the author reading starts at 7:30 p.m., and that'll go for about an hour. And then there'll be a book signing and Q&A. And then the second day, on Thursday, March 20th, at 12:30 is the editing panel in Letterman Building 125. That'll go for about an hour. And Thursday night, again at 7 p.m., we'll have a literary fair. And at 7:30 p.m., imprint in person. Oh, there's one other thing that's happening on Thursday night. And that is, again, an example of how the faculty come together. So our screenwriting professor, Rainy Day Crow, has created a documentary of the first 20 years. And we'll be showing that on the second night at the Imprint In-Person Festival. And so we've gotten shout outs from members of the writing community, and you'll hear from Jill Crispin all about the Imprint Festival and how it came to be. So that's also really exciting this year.
Wow, that is a packed event, a packed two-day event. Katie, you know, being around for 20 years as an event, as a festival, is no small feat. What do you think it is about this particular festival that has maintained its momentum over two decades?
I think it's a very elegant structure. I think that it's very clearly laid out that we have the reading and then the editing panel. But I also think it's because all of our faculty are so invested in this and that we see how much it means to our students. So, you know, behind the scenes, I'm emailing all different faculty members who are promoting this in their classes and offering to read for the festival, for example, or our students also introduce the authors who are coming. So there's a real sense of hospitality and welcome. I think that's part of it, is that everyone's on board.
Yeah. And I love the whole idea back to the networking, because writing is such a solitary, isolating experience but then to be around other writers and get support and be able to talk things out and share ideas and share things you may be working on. Talk about how important that is to the writing process.
You said that so well. I do think that it can feel very isolating to be a writer, but really at the heart of writing is inspiration and conversation. And that when you see it in that way, that it's an opportunity to connect with other people, then that gives your writing a sense of purpose and a sense of life. I really want our students to find their voice, to understand that their work has meaning, that the world is waiting for what they have to contribute. And I just want them to feel inspired, encouraged, supported, and successful.
Oh, I love that. Well, thank you so much for coming into the IPR studios to share more about the Imprint Festival, and congratulations on 20 years.
Thank you so much. Thanks for giving us this opportunity.
Katie Didden is the director of the Creative Writing Program at Ball State University. Full disclosure, J.R. Jameson is one of the hosts of the Facing Project, which is produced here at IPR. In Print is Ball State's Festival of First Books. It takes place next week on Wednesday, March 19th and Thursday, March 20th. This is Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey.
It's time to ask another artist, what are you working on?
We are speaking with author J.R. Jameson. J.R. is also co-founder of the nonprofit organization, The Facing Project, and the host of the Indiana Public Radio show of the same name, The Facing Project. Thank you for talking with us today, J.R.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It feels really odd to be on this side of the mic, but I'm really excited to be in conversation with you.
Oh, I'm so glad you are. Many of us listening today are likely familiar with your first book, Hillbilly Queer, a memoir that was released in 2021. Mm-hmm. And if you're not familiar with it, consider giving it a read. I really enjoyed the book, and in my opinion, it showed a lot of undergirding of love and different experiences and paths and growing through openness. And I think that's poignant right now.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm amazed how the message has continued into 2025. I just told someone the other day, I'm really tired of talking about Hillbilly Queer. I mean, I still do, right? Because the message is important. But it is, I'm amazed by how that message has continued. And I think it just speaks to where we are as a country, too. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea of art reflecting what's happening in the world, that's really what the book is in many ways.
That's so true. And we have a question for you.
Yeah.
Arawewo, what are you working on? Are there books on the horizon?
There are. You know, after I finished Hillbilly Queer, I had to think about, what am I going to write next? Because that's always the question that's asked of every writer and author after something comes out. You kind of want to have that moment where you're just sitting there and happy with what
basking
has been put out into the world and also kind of just taking a break and a breath. Mm-hmm. But you don't get to do that. And people want to know what's next. And so I had to think long and hard about what that was. And for me as a writer, it's always about the what, why, and how. So for me, I'm always like, what do I care about at this particular moment in time? Why do I care so much about this thing that it's keeping me up and I can't stop thinking about it? And how am I going to get other people to care about this too? And I do that through writing, right? And that's the joy of storytelling. So for Hillbilly Queer, for instance, that what, why, and how was where we were in the nation and the world and so kind of are. And what did that look like through the lens of a story with my own father, who was on a different side of politics than I was, right? And if we were trapped in a car taking a road trip, what does that look like? But after all of that, I had to say, what is my next what, why, and how? And I think so much about queer youth and what they're facing right now in the world. Always have, right? Quite frankly. But really right now, youth being under fire, their parents being under fire. And I started to think, how do I lean into my background of young adult literature and work on a YA novel? So I did spend a couple of years writing that YA novel. It's about a boy in Indiana who is 17 and is sent away to essentially conversion therapy. He meets a teenage girl while he's there who is there for all the same reasons, and they hatch a plan to escape. And it's about making one's own way in the world. It's about making their way from Indiana to New York, where they find home among Chinatown's gay community. And it's a story of resilience. And it was a story that I felt was important to write at that time. So I did write that book, and we're in the submission process right now. But one of my beta readers during that process had a question for me that I was like, that's an interesting question. She said, why did he leave Indiana to find comfort and safety? And of course, I could answer that in multiple different ways, right?
Sure.
Like, I don't feel like this is always a safe and welcoming place for LGBTQ people. But at the same time, it's also where I've made my home. So I pondered on that in my book that I'm writing right now, that's currently being drafted in its first draft form. Is about a queer person who chooses to stay in Indiana despite it all.
Okay. I think it's so important to write literature with these themes at this time, mm-hmm. when there are so many people in the LGBTQIA plus community, especially our T friends,
yes.
who are just feeling, unbelievable amount of disrespect and being turned away. So now as you continue to write, does it feel different to you to write nonfiction as your first book was and move into these fictional realms?
A little bit. So my background actually was in fiction. I have an undergraduate degree in creative writing, and I focused mainly on fiction and poetry. I got away from that over time. But after Hillbilly Queer and Hillbilly Queer coming out, and I started thinking about what's next, and I started thinking about where we were in the world, which was in the middle of a global pandemic. And what did I want? I wanted to escape in some ways, right? Even though I'm writing about real things in some ways that are happening in the world, mm-hmm. I wanted to do that through a fictionalized story that I was creating, a world that I create to tell that what, why, and how. So really didn't feel odd to move back into fiction, even though I had moved away from it so many years before.
Well, can you tell us a little bit more about the characters that you were talking about that escaped this conversion therapy?
Yeah, so the main character is Ray, and he is a 17-year-old in Indiana who loves Nirvana. Sorry, Nirvana is a little sheepish, isn't very worldly, comes from a small town. He gets the courage to come out to his parents, his mom, who says, we need to tell your dad, and his dad is not so accepting of his coming out. And the mom also is a little sheepish, and she takes the dad's advice that he needs to be sent away to be fixed. He's the main character. When he gets to Warmoth Academy, which is where they're sent for conversion therapy, he meets Brooke. And Brooke is a little more rough and tumble, comes from a steel town, a bit worldly, has hopped trains in the past to go see shows down in Indianapolis. And she brings out really courage in him to find his own voice and find his own path. And ultimately, the courage to escape the reality that they're in, to live their life by their own terms, even if that meant leaving Indiana.
Well, I'm looking very forward to this book coming out.
Thank you.
Is there some place that we can find what you've done and be on the lookout for your book when it comes out?
Yeah, the best place to find anything I'm working on, if it's any of my writing, speaking engagements, any of that, is jrjameson.com.
Excellent. And also you can hear JR every week on The Facing Project. He's the host, and it airs on Indiana Public Radio Saturdays and Sundays.
Yes, Saturdays at 1, Sundays at 7, or get it anytime on the pod.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for talking
with
us.
Yeah, thank you. This has been so much fun.
Michelle, do you know what time it is?
What time is it, Kara?
It's time for the arts calendar.
Ooh, one of my favorite times.
Muncie Civic Theater is presenting The Importance of Being Earnest by Oscar Wilde in the Kazaza Family Studio Theater this weekend. The play chronicles the antics of two bachelors who create alter egos, both named Ernest. To escape their tiresome lives, they attempt to win the hearts of two women who conveniently claim to only love men called Ernest. For more info, go to MuncieCivic.org.
Rock the Arts is happening Saturday, March 15th at Cornerstone Center for the Arts. The Smoking Horses Band will perform beginning at 7 p.m. Proceeds benefit Cornerstone Center for the Arts.
Of course, there will be lots of ways to celebrate St. Patrick's Day this weekend.
Woohoo!
Woo! Like the St. Patty's 5K run at Summit Lake State Park on Saturday.
Ooh!
Or the Newcastle On Tap St. Patty's Day Party on Saturday.
Fun.
Or how about a blues concert with the Hunter Lee Band at the Farm Stand Second Story Lounge in Muncie on Friday.
Nice.
Or a performance by the Prairie Creek Sirens Saturday at the Herat in downtown Muncie.
Ooh.
Wherever you choose, be safe. Let the shenanigans begin.
Indeed. The annual Indiana Flower and Patio Show kicks off this weekend at the Indiana State Fairgrounds in Indianapolis. See gardening, outdoor living, floral, and plant designs to inspire your next project and much more.
I cannot wait to get my garden planted.
I'm so ready. Being outside makes me, that's all I can think about is I just want to be outside all the time.
Yes.
The Cardinal Chorus and Choral Union will perform at 7:30 p.m. Sunday, March 16th at Ball State's Sursa Performance Hall. The choirs will sing of love in any language.
Ooh, that sounds lovely. Love being the first person to hear new music? The 55th Annual Pellegrini Festival of New Music is Saturday and Sunday, March 14th and 15th at Ball State. This year's fest will include guest composer Zay Munn, the Coalescent Saxophone Quartet, and composers from around the country. More info at bsu.edu/music.
Women of Song and Vox Anima will perform at 7:30 p.m. Tuesday, March 18th at Sursa Performance Hall. This annual choral contribution to Ball State University's Women's Week activities features a variety of music and special guests who all highlight the voices and contributions of women in music and society.
As part of its monthly public domain theater series, Cornerstone will present the film The Man with the Golden Arm on Wednesday, March 19th. The 1955 film features a powerhouse performance by Frank Sinatra as a jazz drummer battling drug addiction while trying to rebuild his life. The movie begins at 6:30 p.m.
On Wednesday, March 19th, artist Justin Favela will be on campus as part of its Arts Alive series. Based in Las Vegas, Justin Favela creates large-scale installations and sculptures reflecting American pop culture and the Latinx experience. The talk begins at 6 p.m.
I highly recommend Googling this artist. You have got to see his installations. They are enormous and colorful and incredibly powerful. Oh. If you have a pop culture event, let us know at indianapublicradio.org/contact. Then click Pop of Culture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. Our Director of Audio Operations is Sean Ashcraft, and our producer is Luke Jones, who will be signing copies of his first novel, Pop of Culture and Parmigiano, at the 60th Annual Imprint Festival in 2065. Our show was hosted by me, Michelle Kinsey.
And me, Kara Duquette. Pop of Culture is a production of IPR. We are outside on the campus of Ball State University.
Love it.